she's getting absent-minded. I know how that goes. And so is her husband. And she thinks, well, maybe I found this in the front room where Uncle Silas took his coffee in, and he left it, and I picked it up. And so she puts it back where it belongs. Well, the next thing you know, Tom and these two little rascals catch Aunt Sally in the kitchen. And Tom says, did you get all your spoons counted for? And she says, yeah, they're all 10 are there. He said, are you sure? And she said, well, I'll prove it to you. She's not going to be backed down by this little rascal. And she goes to the cupboard, gets the box, and takes the spoons and lays them out. There's 10 of them. And says, see, they're all 10 there. And Tom shakes his head and says, I only count 9. And while he's talking to Aunt Sally, they're flim-flamming her. Huck, who is telling the story, says, I smouched one of them spoons and slipped it up my sleeve. And so Tom counts the spoons, and there are only 9 there. And the aunt is just totally amazed and can't believe that she's seeing what she sees. And she said, well, I'm going to count them again, and I'll show you, because I counted 10. And while she's arguing with Tom, Huck slips the spoon out and sets it back out. And she counts the spoons, and there are 10. And Tom does the same thing, argues with her, I see only 9. Huck says, I smouched one of them spoons and slipped it under my sleeve. Well, eventually she gets so disgusted with the process, she just takes everything together, puts them in the box, and puts them away, and she gives up on knowing how many spoons she's got. Well, this is makes me think of, this story came to mind when I read about the return of the sacred articles. Ezra 1, starting at verse 7, tells of how Cyrus returned the articles that had been stolen from God's temple by Nebuchadnezzar. Moreover, King Cyrus brought out the articles belonging to the temple of the Lord, which Nebuchadnezzar had carried away from Jerusalem and had placed them in the temple of his god. Nebuchadnezzar probably worshipped the Babylonian god Marduk. Cyrus, the king of Persia, had them brought by Mithridath, the treasurer, who counted them out to Sheshbazzar, the prince of Judah. And verse 9 goes on. You can't read that, and it's not really important, but it has a precise count of the different items by category. This was the inventory. When we talk about an inventory, that's an official list. You have it in your businesses that you've worked for. Gold dishes, silver pans, gold bowls, matching silver bowls, other articles. And Ezra summarizes them in verse 11, and all there were 5,400 articles of gold and silver. Sheshbazzar brought all these along with the exiles when they came up from Babylon to Jerusalem. Some of these articles, you might wonder, there were certain utensils that the law commanded to be part of the, to be created and to be used exclusively in service at the tabernacle. And when Solomon created this beautiful temple, every aspect of it would have been dazzling. He created he may have created some of these very articles that were being returned to the Jews. And 2 Chronicles, the chapters 3, 4, and 5, tell us about the construction of the temple, if you want to go back to that. And if he had contributed many of these plates and bowls and things, they were 400 years old. So just like any kind of antique, it would have an inherent value of gold or silver, and just the historic value. Second Chronicles 4, these verses tell of some of the things that Solomon contributed: pots, shovels, meat forks, dishes in verse 22, and other things. Numbers talks about things that have to be present in the temple, in the tabernacle. This is by law. These are articles, must-have articles. Fire pans, meat forks, King James Version calls them flesh hooks, shovels and sprinkling bowls. This brings to mind, just all aspects of the sacrificial process, because you have this huge fire going. Somebody has to tend the fire. They have to bring the wood. Somebody has to prepare the animal. They have to take ashes out. The more we concentrate on how the sacrifices were arranged, you come to understand the number of people who were required, the large staff. This even comes into play in the return of the people from Babylon, where Cyrus says any Jews who want to go can go, and more priests volunteered, that priests who were descended from Aaron and who could serve as priests. More went back than Levites. Levites did the heavy lifting. Levites were of the same tribe. Remember, the tribe of Levi had the priests and the descendants of Levi, the Levites. And the priests were descendants of Levi, but they were also descendants of Aaron. So when we talk about a priest, he is descended from Aaron. A Levite can be a priest. A priest can be a Levite, but not every Levite could be a priest, if you can understand that, or if that just makes it muddier. But you needed a big staff to run this place. There was some heavy lifting to be done, wood to be carried, ashes to be carried out, refuse and remnants from the sacrificial fire. And you have dishes. We've mentioned these wonderful, precious dishes. Well, when they get used, they have to be cleaned. You have to have like a kitchen staff. So a lot was involved in the workings of the temple. And you needed utensils. You needed pans and meat forks or flesh hooks in the older English language. Shovels, sprinkling bowls. Joshua talks about this again is a requirement under the law. When they had a battle, went to war against somebody, and they've defeated the enemy, they take the armaments, helmets, crowns, shields, buckles, things that could be made of precious metal. And all of this was salvaged because they could reuse scrap gold, silver, brass to glorify and enhance the tabernacle or continue to use it. These things could that were captured on the battlefield were dedicated to the Lord. And that Joshua 6:19, in reference to these things, uses bronze and iron are sacred. And this is a word that we understand by its similar words. The same Hebrew word of kodesh is translated in NIV as sacred. King James says consecrated, and American Standard says holy. All these mean the same thing in that we know that they are special. We know that we as ordinary persons wouldn't dare handle them or mishandle them. But Kodesh not only means something that's dedicated to God, there's an emphasis on separateness. It belongs here. It doesn't belong there. Certain people can handle it. Certain people cannot handle it. It is separated, quarantined, and it doesn't necessarily carry any kind of moral weight. I didn't bring it up or find the verse, but there is a verse describing pagan worship, worship of idols, in probably one of the books of the Kings, and describes some of the personnel in that worship, and they are also described as Kodesh, the Hebrew word that means sacred. Well, it's sacred to that false god. He is separated. He is consecrated into that service. So we have these articles that have come back, and they've had a kind of a checkered history, a rough ride in their existence. If we're talking about if Solomon created them, there were very dark periods of history in Jerusalem and with the temple, where you had many kings of Judah who were idolaters. 2 Chronicles 28:24 describes King Ahaz. He gathered together the furnishings from the temple of God and cut them in pieces. He abused and vandalized some of the pieces in the temple. He shut the doors of the Lord's temple and set up altars at every street corner in Jerusalem. That's how he was probably the most extreme idolater among the kings of Judah. But there were other kings who set up idols inside the temple. And so these consecrated holy articles may at one time in Jerusalem have been misused in the worship of some of these foreign gods that kings of Judah became fascinated with. So they had a bit of a checkered history and a rough ride. And so we wonder, why all these dishes? Why even have all these dishes that they are able to return them? And to look at the sacrifice, as we read about the sacrifices that are commanded of people to offer to the priests who offer them to God, we think of a process of like, sadly, I mean, I had always carried the image of an incinerator, a disposal, really kind of a wasteful process. What a shame that you have this perfectly fine on the hoof cow, which is commanded to be of the first quality. They could not bring diseased animals to be sacrificed. They could not be scarred, roughed up by other animals and have wounds on them. They couldn't be blind or somehow disabled, where the farmer is just glad to get rid of them. They had to be first quality. And you wonder, well, why waste all this? Was it waste? But if we look and read more closely about the sacrifices, we find that they are not, the sacrificial fire is not an incinerator, a disposal that wastes this valuable asset. It is a place and a means of sharing, cutting up a share, because the offerer and the priests get to benefit from the sacrifice that is brought. Of course, God gets his share, which goes up in flame and goes up in smoke. But let's see, Deuteronomy 18 is talking about these sacrifices, and the role of the priests and the function of the sacrifices are actually, it's putting food on priests' tables. They get a share in sacrifices that are brought. this is the share due to the priests from the people who sacrifice a bull or a sheep, the shoulder, the internal organs, and the meat from the head. You are to give them the first fruits of your grain, new wine and olive oil, and the first wool from the shearing of your sheep. For the Lord your God has chosen them and their descendants of all your tribes to stand and minister in the Lord's name always. This fed the priests. The priests got a share of that sacrifice. And it wasn't just them. They were able to feed their families off of sacrifices that are brought in, and they deserved it. They earned it. They were serving the Lord. And remember, God did not give the tribe of Levi a homeland, a territory. Their portion was from the Lord. There were Levitical towns scattered throughout Israel where they might wait for their rotation to come serve at the temple. In these towns, they may engage in some kind of profession to feed their families. There were a border around these towns where they could have pastures and crops. But as they served at the temple or the tabernacle when that existed, they had a right to a portion of these sacrifices that are brought in. It was a way for the people to support the priesthood. And that was their support, and that was their living. That was their portion. And God gets his share, and he shares it with the priests. And in some cases, we'll look at sacrifices where the person who brings the offer also gets a share and enjoy some of the meat, bread, grain offerings that they bring in. Deuteronomy 18 talks about how if a Levite has come from his town and maybe he had a farm or a business and he sold it and he's on his way to somewhere else, he can stop in where the tabernacle is or the temple. He can get a job there and they'll feed him. They'll put him to work and he can share in this sacrifice, get his share, the Levite share of these sacrifices that are brought in. This is talking about grain offerings out of the law. The priest is to take a handful of the finest flour of the grain offering, and some olive oil together with all the incense on the grain offering. Burn the memorial portion on the altar as an aroma pleasing to the Lord. Aaron and his sons, these are the priests who are on duty, shall eat the rest of it, but it is to be eaten without yeast in the sanctuary area. They are to eat it in the courtyard of the tent of meeting. And there's a fellowship offering that people bring voluntarily. Anyone may present to the Lord. If they offer it as an expression of thankfulness, then along with this thank offering, they are to offer thick loaves made without yeast. And it talks about different kinds of loaves that they are prepared, thick loaves, thin loaves, without yeast. Finally, down at the end, along with their fellowship offering of thanksgiving, they are to present an offering with thick loaves of bread made with yeast. And continuing, they are to bring each kind as an offering, a contribution to the Lord. It belongs to the priest. So we see somebody is bringing food into the tabernacle or the temple. The priest gets a share. He gets his bread delivered. The priest who splashes the blood of the fellowship offering against the altar. The meat of their, or King James says his, if it's a single offerer, the meat of their fellowship offering of thanksgiving must be eaten on the day it is offered. They must leave none of it till morning. Now, it's a little confusing if I had to look at a commentary to make sure it's talking about the person who brings that sacrifice. There's something called Ellicott's commentary, and regarding this verse, he says, that is, after the priests had the breast and the shoulder, the share of the victim, that is the animal, the share of the animal which belongs to the offerer, the person who brought the sacrifice, a part of it belongs to him. Together with the remaining loaves, he with his family and poor guests are to eat up before the morning. This is where somebody brings a sacrifice, but they get to benefit. They get to enjoy it before the Lord in the company of his servants, the priests. The Lord gets his portion, the priests get their portion, and they get their portion. And it is like a communal meal where people come together and draw near to God. It is like sitting down and having a meal with him. And these sacrifices are commanded. People are welcome to do this. And what is the attitude that people should have when we think of sacrifice as loss, as if we wrongly think that this is just a matter of wasting and just obliterating something and getting no use out of it, when in fact it can be like a meeting of God and his servants and oneself in enjoying what we all are happy to have as a meal. We all enjoy eating. The attitude that ought to be present with this, God is talking about coming into the land and forecasting in Deuteronomy 12, verses 7 and 12, about the designated place of sacrifice that will be established. There in the presence of the Lord your God, you and your families shall eat and shall rejoice. Eat and rejoice in everything that you have put your hand to, because the Lord your God has blessed you. And there rejoice before the Lord your God, you, your sons and daughters, your male and female servants, and the Levites from your towns who have no allotment or inheritance of their own. Sacrifice is an occasion of happiness. If there's a meal, I don't know about you, but I'm happy when I get fed. But this occasion to be fed in the presence of the Lord is a celebration, a time of happiness. God has blessed you and enabled you to bring, to collect this sacrifice, to be able to get a good crop, or to produce the bread, or to have some healthy standing livestock. And it's a good thing to eat. People enjoy eating almost as much as anything else they do. And this is a happy time. People should rejoice and be glad that they have come forward with on this occasion. There is a passage that we don't focus on quite as much, but if I misunderstood the process of sacrifice as being a very grim and sad occasion, that you're short one cow, but actually it is a communal meal in the presence of the Lord, occasion that should be welcomed. We don't focus too much on the story that we call the prodigal son. I don't think the word prodigal even appears in the text. But it's introduced, Jesus introduces it as there was a man with two sons. It's really the story of two sons. And when the wandering son comes to himself and comes home and is welcomed back, the brother who never left is very disgruntled. He has never left the presence of his father, who is in character, he represents God. He had never strayed from God, and yet he sees his life with his father as a very dull, grim, unhappy experience. And he complains to his father. He said, this brother has gone and blown his money and spent his life in sinful living, and you never give me a goat to have a party with my friends. And the father says, my son, you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. God, that father is telling his son that he has access to happiness. And if he don't go for it, it's his fault. He said, we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again, and he was lost and is found. The son found no joy in being loyal to his father. And we don't want to view our life, and if we can see that there was happiness and joy and people coming together and assembling with God's servants and in the presence of God, then we ought to be able to find joy and rejoice in our service to God. That's kind of an aside. We're getting off of the pots and pans that were brought back. But speaking of the pots and pans, getting back to those, we know they were looted by Nebuchadnezzar, and that these items had been misused in their history. We know for certain, it's recorded, how Belshazzar, who was ruling Babylon for his father Nabonidus, the last king of Babylon. And Daniel addresses Belshazzar because he had to come to the feast and there was writing on the wall. And Daniel reminds him, he, referring to Nebuchadnezzar, in verse 17 it refers to him as king of Babylon. He carried to Babylon all the articles from the temple of God, both large and small, and the treasures of the Lord's temple and the treasures of the king and his officials. He and Nebuchadnezzar, he's reminding Belshazzar, he was driven away from people and given the mind of an animal. He lived with the wild donkeys and ate grass like the ox, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven until he acknowledged that the Most High God is sovereign over all kingdoms on earth and sets over them anyone he wishes. But you, Belshazzar, his son, that he's actually a grandson, you have not humbled yourself, though you knew all this. Instead, you have set yourself up against the Lord of heaven. You had the goblets from his temple brought to you, and you and your nobles, your wives, and your concubines drank wine from them. You praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which cannot see or hear or understand. But you did not honor the God who holds in his hand your life and all your ways. So we see that these items that had been taken by Nebuchadnezzar, we have a documentation of how they were profaned and abused in a drunken party and also in tribute to some of the false gods that were worshipped in Babylon. As far as the things that were precious and sacred and valued in the temple, this is a verse commanding people, again, to salvage things off the battlefield and how to cleanse them, sterilize them in fire or wash them in water. And these were dedicated to the tabernacle. The wood, the metal was salvaged so that it could be reused in maintaining the temple, or rather maintaining at the time the tabernacle. And when Solomon built the temple in 1 Chronicles 26, verse 27, it says that at that time they still had it. They were like museum pieces. They were historical items that had been kept and stored in the temple. It said some of the plunder taken in battle, during the time of David, dedicated for the repair or maintenance of the temple of the Lord, and everything dedicated by Samuel the seer, and by Saul son of Kish, Abner son of Ner, and Joab son of Zeruiah, and all the other dedicated things were in the care of Shelomith and his relatives. They had things captured by going back to Samuel. Now this was this was two generations back from Solomon at the time. So this is kind of like ancient things or old things, and it could be fascinating what might have still been in the temple. In fact, in the time of Hezekiah, this is rather remarkable. They still had the bronze serpent that God told Moses to create when the people had sinned, and he sent out poisonous snakes to bite them, and the people were dying from these snake bites. God commanded Moses to create a brass serpent and put it up on a pole, and anybody who saw this brass serpent would live. Well, during the time of Hezekiah, about 700 years later, that bronze serpent, which was named Nehushtan, was still in the temple. It was a museum piece. So and Hezekiah destroyed it because people were worshiping it. But we don't know all of what might have been in the temple and taken away, or was still there. But one thing that throws us off is Hebrews 9, verses 3 and 4, which talks about the Ark of the Covenant. Now, I brought it up because I know you were curious about it. The Ark of the Covenant is not mentioned in any of this. It's never mentioned about Nebuchadnezzar stealing it or them bringing it back. So we don't know what happened to it. The writer of Hebrews describes, behind the second curtain was a room called the Most Holy Place, which had the golden altar of incense and the gold-covered Ark of the Covenant. This ark contained the gold jar of manna, Aaron's staff that had budded, and the stone tablets of the covenant. So the writer of Hebrews was talking about the Ark of the Covenant actually containing something, another museum piece, a piece of history, manna that God had distributed to the people on their march through the wilderness, and also Aaron's rod that had budded. However, the writer of Kings, in describing the construction of the temple, says that under Solomon in chapter 8, verse 9, there was nothing in the ark except the two stone tablets that Moses had placed in it at Horeb, where the Lord made a covenant with the Israelites after they came out of Egypt. So by the time of Solomon, Aaron's rod, we don't know what happened to it. It was there at one time, according to the writer of Hebrews. The bowl of manna, we don't know what happened to that, but it was gone by the time of Solomon. So it's just totally amazing that all of these things were so carefully kept and archived and listed. Ezra calls it an inventory, and it reads like an inventory list, say of the fine items department department store, but the bowls and what's gold and what's silver, and so carefully kept up. And this, to me, accounting and keeping track of things is shared by a profession that is represented throughout the Bible, and that is the profession of being a shepherd and keeping track of sheep. Because shepherds, they always knew what they had. They were a little better than Aunt Sally. They knew how many sheep. They had to keep track of them. And so it seemed like a providential care over the items that were returned had kept these items together, protected them, kept them from being melted down by the enemy, mixed in with sacred articles to worship some of the foreign gods. They didn't get dissipated and lost. They were still there, ready to be taken home. And it's not surprising, however, because the Bible presents godly people who also stayed on top of their duties. And one of these was the profession of being a shepherd. One of those people, going back to all the way back to Genesis, where it describes Jacob as being a shepherd, when he's departing from Laban, he talks about, he says, "I have been with you for 20 years now. Your sheep and goats have not miscarried, nor have I eaten rams from your flocks." How would Laban know if Jacob had pilfered out of his flock? Because shepherds keep track of their sheep. "I did not bring you animals torn by wild beasts. I bore the loss myself, and you demanded payment from me for whatever was stolen by day or night." How do you know something is stolen? You keep track of things, and you know if something's missing. So we have an example of the profession of being a shepherd as someone who has to take careful care and an accurate count of what he has, almost like somebody throughout their checkered history and rough road had looked out after this set of utensils and dishes that had been in the temple and were being returned to the children, to the Hebrews, as they are returning back to Jerusalem, where they'll be replaced in the new temple. And it's quite amazing how God watches over things, and we'll talk a little more about that next week. Any questions? I appreciate your attention, and don't get smouched.